Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:35 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is December 31st, so Happy New Year to all of our subscribers, wherever you might be. And I thought we'd kick off with gold. And this is the long-term chart, and of course it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes as well. So gold surged higher in the 1970s. And that also accompanied a period of weak US dollar activity. And then it had another big move in the 2000s and in the early 2000s. And that also coincided with a period of weaker dollar activity. So now gold prices surged again in 2018 and 19 and into 2020 in direct response to the pandemic shutdown. And the dollar during that time hasn't been weak. It's been quite firm. So we're in a slightly different environment here. And we can also think about the fact that the times when emerging markets have tended to do best, and more broadly speaking, ex-US assets have tended to do best, were during periods of time when the dollar was weak. So in many respects, the outlook for the currency and the health of the domestic US economy is in large part a linchpin for enthusiasm for ex-US assets. And if we're going to see the value opportunities that are currently available in places like Europe and Japan and the UK, or in the commodity markets in gold, or China or India, start to return to positions of relative outperformance, then it's integral to that argument that the dollar would also have to devalue relative to their respective currencies. And that doesn't just mean that those areas will need to allow their currencies to appreciate, but rather that the US dollar would also have a sufficiently large problem that it would be less desirable to hold dollars. So as we go forward and look at what we can anticipate from 2020, the 2020s and 2022 in particular, well, then perhaps it's interesting that gold prices have been going sideways for most of the last 6 months. And that was following a swift decline from the peak in August of 2020. Now, we can go back and look at the big bull market that started in the early 2000s. And we had plenty of examples of gold, that of the gold price, where it went sideways for anything up to 18 months at a time. And we also had this rather odd consistency characteristic, that it broke out in the Septembers of uneven years. So we had our first 18-month consolidation, and it climaxed in 2005. It broke out again in September of 2007, and broke out again in September of 2009. So when people start to understand the consistency, then they anticipate it. And by the time, and it takes time, in this case, it took 7 or 8 years for people to understand that there was this broad trend in the market. And then they begin to anticipate it. And by anticipating it, they change it. So that's when we started to see the trend become much more consistent. And this is a perfect example of the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets. Because back in 1998 and 1999, or all the way through to 2002 and 2003, nobody really believed that gold could rally by upwards of 5 times over the course of the next decade. There were lots of people who thought that gold had plenty of potential. There were a lot of people who looked at the big move that we had in 1999 following the UK selling its gold. And when we think about all of those factors, those are the people that were very bullish on gold because they looked at it and saw a base formation, well, nobody was really listening to them. Then, as we moved into this trending phase, now it was choppy. There is absolutely no question of that. And when we look at the size of the moves in terms of percentages, going from almost $400 down to 300 and change is a very significant retracement of what had been a really impressive breakout. So, obviously, these kinds of events, they're not confidence inspiring. So then prices continue to rise. So what it then helps to engender is a buy the dips mentality, that if one has the fortitude to sit through the big pullbacks, then you will be rewarded with higher prices in future. And the longer that goes on, and it takes years to engender that kind of psychology. Well, of course, what that also helps to do is to ensure that people won't sell. So they may want to take some profits following the big moves on the upside, but many people are unwilling to do that because they become so conditioned by the size of the breakouts, by the rewards that they've received for sitting through the big declines. So they don't want to sell. And in fact, what they want to do is to wait for a dip and buy even more, because that's the most rewarding type of scenario that you could possibly have in a big bull market. And then when the realization comes that there is a cyclicality to the market and that it tends to break out in Septembers. Well, it broke out in the uneven years of Septembers, but by the time we got around to 2010, it was breaking out again. And that was in September of an even year. So then we could definitely see that the pace of the advance was picking up. So now if we think about what happened with gold, well, we did have the big breakout in 2019. And then we had a fairly substantial retracement in 2020 and a really big snapback and push on to new all-time highs and got it all the way up to the big psychological 2000 level. So that was a new all-time high. And of course, it coincides with the previous peak around the 2011 peak around $1,900. And since then, prices have been mostly ranging below the all-time peak. Now, one thing that I think is particularly relevant is that there has been a tendency among people to look at this range that took place in 2011 and 12 and to consider that there's a high degree of commonality with what we've seen recently. And particularly with this pop on the upside, which was quite similar to the pop on the upside in 2012, which subsequently failed. And I had a subscriber send me an email just before I started recording with some forecasts from some of the bigger banks. So, JP Morgan is anticipating a price of about $1,520, which would be more than a full retracement down to the 1,000-day moving average. UBS is also anticipating that prices will probably fall back towards that 1,500 area, and they are rationalizing that view with the argument that there is going to be rising rates and inflationary pressures are going to moderate. So then that will rob gold of its ability to continue to rally. And against that background, one thing that I think is relevant here is that the big move that we had in the decade up to that peak at $1,911 then followed a period of ranging is very different from this very clear rounding characteristic to the base formation and the initial breakout. So what we have right now continues to look like a big first step above the base. And what that looked like was a top formation, because we had the acceleration and then a very clear acceleration of that move, and then the loss of uptrend consistency and a breakdown. And we still have the sequence of higher reaction lows within this range. So there is the clear potential that what we're looking at here is another rounding characteristic, and that the breakout, when it comes, will be dynamic in nature. But of course, it will be significantly improved upon if the dollar index were to trend lower, because obviously gold is denominated in dollars. And obviously it's denominated in lots of other currencies too, and it is appreciating versus lots of those. Now, the one thing that I've been rather interested in is the cyclicality of the dollar index, because it has tended to trend with approximately a 7-year uptrend, downtrend phase, with a bit of messing around in between. Well, historically at least, the peaks have not been particularly long-term affairs. So if this is a peak, well then, it is looking like a rather long-term affair, because it's been ranging now for 7 years. Well, technically it's about 7 years. So the big question then is, since we're now mid-range, is it going to break on the upside? And is the dollar about to move out of this 7-year cycle, up and down cycle, and into a more trending phase, so that it will become among the strongest currencies in the world for years at a time? Or has this very long-ranging phase softened it up sufficiently that there are other currencies are on the cusp of appreciating more? Well, then we have to look at how is the dollar performing versus other currencies, and what do those other currencies look like. So the euro is at least steadying, and it has been in a very volatile range for most of the last 50 years. So as we then think about this, we're in the middle of the range, and Europe is not in a sufficiently negative environment such as we had immediately after the introduction of the euro. So if the euro were to firm and Europe's economy were to do better, well then that would at least bolster the potential for the euro to start to take away some of the dollar strength. And a large part of that calculus is going to be very much centered on how well China does. And of course, China's currency has been more or less pegged to the dollar for most of the last decade. So the big question then for 2022 is, will China continue to accelerate the appreciation of the renminbi, or are they going to devalue it? And alternatively, will they try and hold the currency steady versus the dollar, while simultaneously attempting to support the stock market and the property developers more generally? Because what we've certainly started to see here is that there's an increasing number of the property developers are going bust, and China Evergrande is now back at levels, and the chances are that within the next few years the share will no longer exist. But the price now is at lows that haven't been seen in a decade, and the number of property developers going bust continues to increase. So ultimately, the Chinese government is going to have to do something. There is a significant deleveraging going on within the property sector. So obviously then, that is going to have a knock-on effect. One of the things that I think is relevant is that we've often thought about the yield curve spread. And the yield curve spread is a graphic representation of the most basic of relationships within the financial sector, which is the spread and or the pickup one can enjoy in from borrowing short and lending long. So historically, that's been how banks made money. They borrowed from their depositors and they lent it in back to their depositors in the form of mortgages, and they picked up the spread in those two rates. And of course, the financial sector is a lot more complicated than that these days, but it's the basic premise that's important. So China was able to bail out its banking sector because they created a very wide spread between deposits and the lending rate. And basically, they created an artificially low deposit rate and then created a high lending rate. So the banks were recapitalized after the big devaluations that occurred prior to the accession to the World Trade Organization. And the banking sector really took off in 2006 and 2007, but we can see that prior to that, nothing had been going on, and it had been managed in a very conservative fashion. And we're back in a very conservative fashion for monitoring the banking sector, but banks are inextricably linked to property developers, because property developers are liquidity plays. They invest in buying property, developing property, and selling property. And in order to fund that long-term way of playing the market, they need funding. And they need access to liquidity in large quantities at low rates and at exactly the right time that they need it. And that's no longer available to the sector. So there's a significant rationalization going on, and consumer sentiment is on tenterhooks. But then, of course, there's the additional challenge for China, which, when we think about 2022, the one thing that no one has been worried about with regard to China for the last 2 years has been its response to the coronavirus. But one thing that we can certainly look at is that the Omicron variant is extraordinarily virulent. And just people that we know, a large number of people we know have been traveling over the course of the New Year holiday. One person is stuck in London because she can't fly home because she can't get a negative test. A couple of other people have been stranded in Canada because they have also contracted the coronavirus while they're over there. And there are lots of other people locally who have been self-quarantining with the Omicron variant. Now, the vast majority of people report that they're having extremely mild symptoms and that it's not much more than a bad cold. But that doesn't matter for China, because the sheer volume of potential patients and the speed with which it travels could have a significant knock-on effect for the economy. The one thing that that China was able to do during the initial portion of the pandemic was to isolate huge numbers of people within the dormitories of factories. So they had a captive workforce. They were able to keep their factories working and satiate the demand for products from the rest of the world. And that helped to inflate the trade balance for China. But the big question for 2022 is whether that's going to continue to be the case. Because if the Omicron variant, and it has not yet appeared in China, gains a foothold, and it's as virulent as measles, then it's going to rip through the Chinese economy. And that has the real potential to enhance the scope for a fiscal stimulus. So if they try to hold the currency and start pumping on stimulus, well, then that's going to have a significant positive effect on asset prices. And it's a good part of the reason why the Golden Dragon Index popped on the upside yesterday. So this is US-listed Chinese companies. And investors are willing to bet that the nearly 61% decline we've seen since the peak in March is about as low as the index is going to go. When we look at the biggest constituents, or the biggest movers yesterday, and again in here today, we have large numbers of speculative companies, but companies like Alibaba have been viewed as potential beneficiaries of the end of the opprobrium that's been heaped upon the tech sector, and the value that's been created by the share pulling back by 60%, and in fact it's more than that, and there's the potential here that we're approaching a low. So that at least is also the bet that people are willing to make, that China will embark upon a significant fiscal stimulus next year, and that will also help to fuel speculative activity. But the big question for the ex-US portion of the market isn't simply whether it can go up, but whether it is going to have the wherewithal to capture investor interest. When we think about the relative performance of the mega cap shares in the USA, well, they remain quite steady. And the ratio broke out to new all-time highs in December. And we have a little consolidation going on right now, but it still represents 22.5% of the total market cap of the USA. So in order for the stock market in the USA to roll over, then this ratio would have to start trending downwards. When eight companies represent such a large weighting of the total market, well then what happens to them is going to have a significant bearing on sentiment towards the wider economy. And the big question for these types of companies and their continued ability to sustain bull markets is going to be very focused on liquidity. And of course, liquidity is global and mobile. And we can think about companies like Amazon, where it has been, where it surged higher in 2020, and it's been then ranging for most of this year. And it's closing out the year below the 200-day moving average. Now, over the course of the last year, there have been plenty of times when it has traded below the trend mean. And on every single one of those, it has been able to rebound. And Amazon is trading on a price-to-sales ratio of 3.7, which is not aggressive. But all of its profit, or the majority of its profits, come from the Amazon Web Services portion of the business. And it's the kinds of companies that use that web services division are those that are among the worst performers this year. So Peloton, for example, they sell the home exercise equipment, but their major selling point is their online classes. And those online classes and the data involved with them requires a lot of rack space in data centers. And it's just one of the companies that has been attempting to gain market share during the pandemic that's in trouble right now. So when we think about the cloud computing sector, all of these companies, they either benefit from selling rack space or selling services to companies that are paying for rack space. And if those companies are the ones that are least likely to benefit from the end of the pandemic and the normalization of the economy, it could have a knock-on effect for companies like Google, Microsoft, and Amazon. So I think Amazon is particularly noteworthy because of the very lengthy range. And of course, investors have been conditioned to expect that. But then we can think about the cloud computing sector. And I think the most relevant thing that it has right now is the big failed upside break in November. Then it pulled all the way back down and it broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. And now it's pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. So there's the potential that what we might anticipate in 2022 is a reordering of performance within Wall Street. But the way that I've been describing the outlook for ex-US markets, and I created this, I'm not going to remember my, let me see if I can go. So I created a chart in here today of the MSCI ex-US market relative to the MSCI US. So this is the USA relative to the world. Well, it's the rest of the world relative to the US. So it's been trending down since 2007. And there are a lot of arguments being posed right now to suggest that we're going to see a significant reordering of performance, and that it is the ex-US portion of the market is going to play significant catch-up, and it is going to outperform Wall Street. But this ratio is still consistent on the downside. So until we start to see the dollar breaking downwards, it's not going to be a sufficiently large catalyst to change the outlook for this particular ratio. But what I think is also relevant is that it's during the periods when the dollar is weak that we tend to see this ratio do best. So this is another graphic example of how the dollar is the linchpin for ex-US investing. It's the push factor that forces US-based investors to go out and seek opportunities around the world. And what I also find interesting is that when we just contrast this chart with the value versus growth chart, well, it's eerily similar. So in many respects, what we can also say is that the ex-US versus US argument is in many respects similar to the value versus growth argument. And certainly we had this massive outperformance of growth versus value in 2020. And we've had a loss of momentum in terms of that ratio over the course of the last 12 months, but not sufficiently large to really encourage a significant outflow from growth. Now, of course, some portions of the growth and innovation sector have underperformed in a big way this year. And the ARK Innovation ETF, what they profited from was this massive quantity of money that flowed into the market in 2020. And the value of the ETF went up 4 times. So that was a spectacular move. But then we have to think about some of the companies that they were investing in. So 3D Systems had a wonderfully impressive advance in 2010 through 13, and they went on an enormous buying spree and tried to buy up the entire 3D printing sector, and then collapsed and did nothing really between 2016 and 2020. And then during the meme stock phase of the market in early 2020, then it really popped on the upside, and ARK Innovation was a good portion of that buying and was very heavily publicizing it. But the reality is that the arguments being used to support why one should be buying it were identical to those that had been made a decade ago, and no one has yet come up with a solution to mass manufacturing, because the reality is that the technology hasn't really improved all that much in the last decade. There's certainly 3D printing available for more different kinds of materials, but the speed of that deposition type of manufacturing is significantly slower than mass production. So without mass production, then why would one be owning it? Now, obviously, it's the kind of thing that can be used for marketing material. It's the kind of thing that will appeal to people when prices are moving around in a really aggressive manner. But if the basic questions haven't been fulfilled, then growth is more about enthusiasm than reality. And of course, we have the big question then is about Tesla, because the share is worth $1 trillion. And they've just announced a massive recall of 500,000 vehicles. Now, 500,000 vehicles isn't a lot of vehicles when we talk about a company like Volkswagen or Toyota, but 500,000 vehicles for Tesla is almost all the vehicles they produced in 2019. So it's a big deal, and the share is off its highs. Now, we had the big upside key reversal last week, and that confirmed at least near-term support in the region of the 200-day moving average and the all-time high. So it absolutely needs to hold that low if the benefit of the doubt is to be given to the upside. If this portion of the market, these extraordinarily large cap companies, do roll over, well, then it's going to represent a green light for ex-US assets. So Europe is right in the region of the upper side of this extremely long-term range, and it's firming from that level. And at the FTSE 100 has a very similar pattern, although it did have the bigger pullback in 2020. But it's also now back above the 7,000 level. And when we then think about some of the other markets, particularly those that are more commodity oriented, then Australia has a similar pattern overall, and it is now consolidating above the peak from 2007 and from back in early 2020. So this looks like the end of a very lengthy ranging phase. So there's obviously scope for strong performance. It's really only a question of whether we also get relative outperformance, and that will be in large part down to the health of the various currencies. Now, as we think about what is likely and what are the assets that will do best, well, copper prices continue to hold here around the $4 area. And it looks like another consolidation in the region of an extremely long-term range. So this does not look all that dissimilar from the kinds of chart patterns we see in Australia or Europe or even Japan. And I think this is not a coincidence, that it's an argument that commodities, emerging markets, value opportunities, catch-up plays do best when the dollar doesn't. So they're starting to do better, and the jury is still out on whether the dollar's rally can be sustained. But the kinds of assets that would do well in an environment where the dollar does badly are all starting to firm. And that, of course, brings us back to gold, because the price has been ranging in the region of the peak from back in 2011 for a year, and it's beginning to steady once more. So it's not incontrovertible proof that gold is priming for a significant pop on the upside, but it doesn't look all that unlikely either. Then we can contrast this kind of performance with what we're seeing on Wall Street, because some of these indices, they don't look happy. And the Russell 2000 rebounded impressively last week, and it's in positive territory in here today. But the size of the advance, it looks like it's on a stalk. And again, we have the failed upside break. So the price had the upside weekly key reversal last week and held it in here this week. But these US denominated assets don't look as well supported as the European or ex-US assets. So if we're looking for what the potential is, then yes, there is scope for ex-US assets to outperform. And if they start to outperform, then it's likely to be a lengthy affair. But then we can also think about what that means in terms of the bond market. Because the one thing that is completely unanswered is, what are they going to do in terms of interest rates? Every significant move higher in the bond yield is going to represent an almost catastrophic increase in the cost of servicing the USA's national debt. And we have this political environment right now where the Democrats are trying to push through this enormous spending plan, which hands out goodies to all of the constituencies that normally vote for them, and they can't seem to get it pushed through. And there's a midterm election coming up in November of 2022, so they pretty much know that if they're going to get a new spending package pushed through, it's going to have to happen in the first quarter of 2022 so that it can start having an effect and bolster their chances of winning that election. Of course, they could fail, and there might not be an additional spending package. And of course, if there isn't an additional spending package, that would help to moderate the inflationary pressure. And of course, if the inflationary pressures moderate, well then, the chances of raising interest rates or the necessity to raise interest rates evaporates. And then, why would anyone need to hold the dollar? Because the reason why people have wanted to hold the dollar is because of the willingness of the Federal Reserve to remove accommodation and the potential that interest rates will rise in the USA first and later everywhere else. But the bond yield is only at 1.5%, and it's been ranging here for the last 6 months. So bond investors, they're willing to give some credence to the view that the Federal Reserve will raise rates, but they're not panicked about it. And we can also then think about the high yield sector, and bond yields there are competitively priced, and the spread is continuing to contract again. So high yield investors aren't worried about inflation either. What it suggests is that the inflationary pressures that everyone has been worried about in 2020 are going to abate in 2021. And the Baltic Dry Index peaked below 6,000, and now it is coming down sharply, and it's back to 2,200. Now, the one thing that I've heard repeated by everyone who's trying to sell anything is that shipping costs are up 10 times in the last year. But if we look at the Baltic Dry Index, that's not true. The only way that one could make that argument is to take the peak values and the trough values. So if you take the trough from from February of 2020, and the price went up more than 10 times to the peak back in October. But since then, the price has come down by well in excess of 50%. So at a reading of 2,200, and if we think about where the price was at the beginning of 2020, it was at 1,300. So we're not even at a double of where the shipping rates were a year ago. And that's going to take time to start filtering back into the public psychology. It might even take a year. But the reality is that shipping rates are going to start coming down in 2022, and that's likely to contribute to less inflation. And then when we think about the fact that Taiwan Semiconductor said in plain English that they were going to increase supply of microcontrollers by 60% by the end of the year, and the share has stopped rising. So we had this incredible acceleration in 2020, and the price has gone nowhere for most of the last 10 months. So these broadening patterns following accelerations, they're not usually reliable continuation patterns. And we've seen a preponderance of downward dynamics from the upper side of this range. And Samsung has already broken lower. So when we then think about what that means in terms of semiconductors, well, there's the potential that we've seen the best of it. Now, definitely there's companies like Nvidia, which control their own niche of the semiconductor sector, and it's done spectacularly well. But we're also starting to see some loss of uptrend consistency here. So we had the big rebound just before Christmas, and it's been down the last 4 days in a row. So it would suggest at least that the kinds of the bits of the market that have done spectacularly well, they still occupy very large portions of the total market cap. And the big question then is, are we going to see the additional liquidity necessary to continue to fuel their advances? And if we don't, then what's going to justify their massive valuations? And if the Democrats don't follow through and boost their fiscal spending, and China's fiscal spending is more focused on the ex-US portion of the global economy than the US portion, could that then represent the weakness of the dollar necessary to fuel an ex-US rebound? And I think one thing that's particularly relevant is when we think about value, the Vanguard Value ETF is at new all-time highs. And it's at not far off a multiple from the low in 2020. But it's up a lot since 2009. And the big constituents are things like Berkshire Hathaway, J.P. Morgan, and Johnson & Johnson. So those are autonomies, but they're very big companies, and they have very large US operations. And we can think then that they also have big, well, perhaps not so much for Berkshire Hathaway, but most of the other big constituents have big non-US businesses. And they should do well in an ex-US outperformance phase. And particularly if the dollar goes down, then they repatriate their foreign earnings into a depreciating currency. So they could potentially then represent a safe haven for a US-based investor. But ultimately, the wider ex-US sector will outperform in a much more impressive fashion. And then we can think about the kinds of places where there is really outsized growth. So India is at the beginning of a new credit cycle, and the Nifty index bounced last week from the region of the 200-day moving average and improved upon that performance in here this week. So this is a place where you have significant scope for credit growth and the potential for benefits to be reaped from the demographic dividend and the wider growth potential of the global economy, and certainly as the geopolitical sands shift and investors start to look at ex-China assets, then certainly India is the first port of call because of its favorable labor costs and demographics overall. But of course, one of the things that people don't have surety on is the currency. And the Indian rupee hasn't really strengthened for any kind of sustained time. There have been occasions, usually lasting about 4 or 5 years, where the rupee has been comparatively stable. And it certainly rebounded over the last 2 weeks. Now, if the rupee can break that sequence, the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows, well, that's going to be a very significant event in terms of attracting foreign interest into the market. So I think that we're at a rather critical juncture for risk assets generally. I don't believe there's any potential for a recession before about 2024. The yield curve spread is still in quite clearly positive territory. It's hovering here around the 77 basis point level. And it's usually the time between around these levels and the negative reading that we get the best performance in stock markets. And ultimately, we get an inverted yield curve, and that deters liquidity creation and generally leads to a recession. But we're nowhere near that yet. What I suspect is, though, that the phenomenal performance of the cloud computing sector and the stay-at-home champions is going to be challenged in 2022. And we've already started to see that some of the companies that did particularly well, like Zoom and Peloton, have already performed in a very negative fashion over the course of the last year. And they don't provide sufficiently important or convenient services to be viable over the long term. And both of them have got significant competition. But I think the most important thing is that the landlords for these kinds of companies are the largest companies in the world. So, the rack space that Microsoft, Google, and Amazon sell is a very significant factor. Now, it doesn't mean that just because these shares have got scope to underperform for a while that they're going to crash. But We certainly know they've gone up a lot. And Apple, in particular, has done spectacularly well over the course of the last 18 months. And it's closing in on the 3 trillion market cap. And 3 trillion in terms of the market cap for anything is still a lot of money. Even though we're in an environment where trillions and trillions are being printed, at the market cap for a single company being $3 trillion is an extraordinary sum, which for a company that really sells phones is just an incredible sum of money. And ultimately, it's going to engender more competition. So as we think about what the upside potential is. Well, is Apple going to get to a market cap of 6 trillion? Well, the only way that that's likely is if we see massive new liquidity injections. And I think this is a particularly relevant consideration for Bitcoin. Because I started off this broadcast talking about the consistency of gold. And we go back and think about the kinds of ways that people thought about gold in the early 2000s and up to 2011. They were conditioned to buy the dip. They were conditioned to think about it in terms of 18-month consolidations and breakouts in Septembers of uneven years. And that gold turned in a positive performance for 10 consecutive years. So all you had to do was buy it, and the price would be higher a year from now. Well, then you can think about Bitcoin, because we have a very similar conditioning effect. The price has done spectacularly well since its genesis. And anyone, despite the volatility, despite the fact that prices can and have pulled back by 80 and 90%, anyone who's held Bitcoin for 4 years has made money. Now, that's a really dangerous conclusion, because if you're telling someone that all you have to do is hold on for 4 years and you'll make money, it means that it's going to engender a great deal of faith. You have to have faith for 4 years. In other words, if you buy today, you shouldn't really look at your portfolio again until December 31st, 2025. And at that point, Bitcoin will be significantly above where prices are today. Now, that's an incredible faith-based way of investing. And it assumes that every single bullish attribute that's been proposed for Bitcoin will be achieved. But the one thing that we know is that the price accelerated higher in 2020 and into 2021. And then it had a deep pullback, and it halved, and then it rebounded, and that rebound was really consistent. And then it failed to sustain the breakout, and it pulled back below 60, and then it pulled back into the underlying range. And today it is sustaining the move below the 200-day moving average. So it's in no way still consistent. If the trend is going to be resolved and we're going to move back into a more consistently trending environment, well, then the price is going to have to rebound and do so soon. And it's going to have to then put in one range above another again and rebuild that consistency. But Bitcoin, more than Apple, depends on the law of large numbers. So Bitcoin has tended to preempt the massive surges in global liquidity. It did really well in 2017, and it did spectacularly well in 2020, and of course it came into existence during 2008. And the big flurry of activity occurred in approximately 2012. So we had the big pop on the upside with QE2 in 2011. Then we had QE3 in 2013 and 14. And I'm not entirely sure whether I'm getting those dates exactly correct, but there is no question that Bitcoin has done exceptionally well in an environment which has been completely, or has had liquidity provision on a scale never seen previously. So the big question, of course, is that at a market cap of $1 trillion, where there is no real use case that's essential, there are lots of use cases for Bitcoin that are nice to have, but none that are essential. And the speculation on the limited supply argument has, in many respects, migrated to the non-fungible token sector and migrated to the altcoin sector because Bitcoin's expensive. So in order to fuel institutional interest in the cryptocurrency, we need to see additional new liquidity coming into the market. And I do think that Bitcoin is a relevant lead indicator for interest in the FANG stocks and then the broader speculative portion of Wall Street, because it's a lightning rod for liquidity, and Tesla is a lightning rod for liquidity. It represents more than 50% of all the open interest in the options market. So if Bitcoin continues to trend lower, well then that's going to represent a lead indicator for interest in liquidity-fueled rallies. And that has the potential to move the needle in terms of the push factor into non-US assets. So what we're seeing at present is the ex-US assets looking increasingly like they're firming and beginning to attract interest. And the non-US assets, it's certainly not at a done deal yet. And the Fangman relative shares continue to do reasonably well. But Bitcoin's breaking downwards. And Amazon looks susceptible to additional downside. And we still have these innovation type companies that are underperforming in a significant fashion. So there's the potential that what we're going to see in 2022 is a reordering, although we don't have a lot of evidence to support it just yet. And I think with that, I will leave you for this week and this year, and wish all the best to all of you.